Robert K. Kellogg Foundation will begin its 31st year of operation on behalf of education, health, and social welfare. Established by the late W.K. Kellogg, the foundation has contributed millions of dollars each year toward the advancement of material gain, ideals, and ideas in the world. We are honored this afternoon to have as our commencement speaker the president of this foundation, Dr. Emory W. Morris. As most of you know, it was the Kellogg Foundation which in 1949 deeded the Kellogg Arabian Horse Ranch at Pomona to the California State Polytechnic College. Most of you have visited this part of Cal Poly. This campus, in the past year, had 1,700 students, with plans for 2,400 in 1960-61 and 12,000 in 1970. There has already been spent $20 million in improvements for this beautiful and spacious campus. It has been through the interest, energy, and enthusiasm of Dr. Emory Morris that we have acquired this valuable property. During the last 12 years that I have known Dr. Morris, he has maintained a continuing interest in our Cal Poly program. It was because of the excellent program that we have here at San Luis Obispo that he prevailed upon Mr. Kellogg and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation to make the gift to us. I have frequently gone to him for advice and assistance in the solution of our many problems. Dr. Morris joined the Kellogg Foundation in 1933 and became its president and general director in 1943. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan, and before joining the Kellogg Foundation, he enjoyed a successful professional career at Battle Creek, Michigan. Dr. Morris has been awarded honorary degrees by Michigan State University, Tufts College, and Loyola University. He is associated with a number of professional societies, dental education groups, service clubs, and fraternal orders. We are extremely fortunate in having as our speaker today such an outstanding friend of our Cal Poly program. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Emory Morris, President and General Director of the W.K. Kellogg Foundation.
President McPhee, deans and members of the faculty, members of the class of 1960, your friends and relatives, ladies and gentlemen. A university commencement is a happy occasion, a day of rejoicing over a culmination of years of hope, striving, and achievement. Important as will be the triumphs of you graduates and the adventure tomorrow, today will remain as a significant memory. Never quite lost will be the memory of this lovely campus, of warm-hearted classmates and understanding professors, of thrilling, even though not painless, learning experiences. And I trust, too, that never quite lost will be the memory of the sacrifices of your parents, those sacrifices which helped make possible your graduation from this great institution. As your home folks sit in the audience today, I am sure they hold an admixture of selfless love and pride over your achievements. Along with felicitations to you for scaling this real summit in your life, and the members of the faculty of California State Polytechnic College for their manifest recognition that education is the vital undergirding of our society. Time and again, they have demonstrated their belief that education must come to the middle of the stage of life, realizing that modern society is dependent every hour of every day upon a literate, well-informed people. I have long had admiration for Dr. McPhee's leadership and educational philosophy, and share the conviction of many that the philosophy of education he pioneered here is a refreshing and stimulating departure from more staid patterns. The world is full of untold novelties for him who has the eyes to see them. Here on the campus, you have been exposed to education not of the obvious, but education is allied with the imaginative life. You have come to realize that the great end of life is not knowledge itself, but proper action, which has been stimulated and dictated by knowledge. Despite criticisms of education by a certain retired admiral, and by others whose observations of schools, colleges, and universities have been quite superficial, I share the belief of many that modern education is perceptibly improving and is correctly pointed towards a richer, fuller life for individuals and their communities. It is as if we at last are willing to listen to the writer of the Book of Proverbs, who put it so realistically when he said, "For there is no vision, the people perish." Perhaps this ancient prophet might have subscribed to the underlying truths of this parable of today. Once upon a time, there was a man who found a shiny dime in the road. From that time on, his mind was focused on small things. He seldom lifted his eyes from the ground while walking. At the end of 10 years, he had accumulated 34,900 buttons, 54,700 pins, a handful of pennies, a silver dollar, a bent back, and a bad disposition. He had lost the smile of friends, the glory of the skies, the beauties of nature, the opportunities to serve his fellow man and pull for a great perspective. Yes, where there is no vision, the people perish. As emerges a decade of 1960, you leave the microcosm of the campus for the macrocosm of the working world. And you do so with great anticipation, as well as with some real fears. Admittedly, 1960, with all its overtones of international strains and personal anxieties, is not the best of all possible times for launching your career. Neither were the lean years of the 1930s, the optimum period for the efforts of your parents to carve a niche in the hard superstructure of the world. But always there are opportunities for the brave and the vigilant. As young citizens of real potential, let us pray that you have great visions of what your generation and mine together can accomplish. And let us compel our visions to completion. In the first quarter of the 18th century, George Berkeley, the great Irish philosopher, wrote a poem on the prospect of planting arts and learning in America. Today we chiefly remember Berkeley for a famous line from that poem: "Westward, the course of empire takes its way." And the fact that 140 years later, his vision inspired the founders of a university in the then young state of California to name their new college town Berkeley. As you will recall, the course of empire did take its way westward, and the great golden empire of California owes its debt of gratitude to many men of unusual stature: the pioneer Franciscan Padres, John A. Sutter, Captain J.C. Fremont, Commodore John Drake Sloat, as well as to the mountain men, the scouts, the buffalo hunters, the first settlers. California said, "Bring me men to match my mountains." And they arrived, these men. They were rough and tough individuals of diverse training and ancestry, but they were united by one common bond, the passionate love for personal freedom. Frontier days are gone, and today your future and mine are linked with the progress of an industrial economy based on increased specialization. No one should decry the value of teamwork as a requisite amount of loyalty to group standards and group judgments, for man is a social animal. Adam had scarcely surveyed the horizon when Eve and marriage were invented. Children appeared next, and the family as an institution was established. Such social structures tended to favor the survival of the social creature and the disappearance of a loner. The independent soul who lived by himself was too easy prey for individual forces. Perhaps modern society makes it inevitable that we find our satisfactions within a variety of groups, in the corporations, the unions, the professional and service associations. But let us also remember it is as important to learn how to live away from the group as within it. We can't wish the oak tree back into the acorn. We're going to have more organization, not less. However, as an educated man, you can alone judge the measure of conformity you will trade for convenience, for comfort, for respectability. The essence of the American dream all these many years has been faith in the free conscience, the inner integrity, and the supreme worth of individual man. I should like to say this to the class of 1960. Your university education designates you as a potential community leader. Learning is the weapon by which we attack the barriers of poverty, prejudice, and ignorance. Your services will be sought, and such should be your loyalty to the community that your response will be in the affirmative. But then you, as an educated man, have the responsibility to walk the tightrope between two undesirable extremes. On the one hand, the anarchist who sees everybody out of step but Johnny, and on the other hand, the conformist who lets others do his thinking for him. Young people of intellect, sensitivity, and courage can rout static social life and mediocre standards, cultural lag, and spiritual and intellectual poverty. Through a lifelong thirst of learning and a commendable unrest which demands a richer, fuller life for the individual and community, today's college graduates can create a renaissance in our way of living. It is your responsibility to bring to your particular community some creative sparkle in the daily routine. And the time and the taste for the life of the mind is contrasted with all our too great preoccupation for creature comforts and gadgets. Such follow-through on your part is also a privilege, for happiness consists of worthwhile activities. It is a running stream, not a stagnant pool. Recently, I read Eric Fromm's Escape to Freedom. Freedom from serfdom, overlordship, ignorance, and fear. But I ask myself, freedom for what? Sometimes we can only agree with a sagacious pogo when he relates, "You have met the enemy, they are us." Here it comes. It's the big job of education, and of you as a product of education, to decide for what we as a people are going to use for freedom. Bored citizens, poor readers, worse voters are a direct result of a failure to stimulate a continuous thirst of knowledge and ethical behavior on the part of adult citizens. The trouble with most of us, when we get behind the wheel of a motor car, 5 or 10,000 years slip by. And behavior-wise, we're practically back in the Stone Age. No quarter, weakest to the wall, every man for himself. As indicated by the French phrase, noblesse oblige, the educated man, by virtue of training and position, is obligated to act in a noble and decisive manner. And this must be more than lip service to an ideal. More than was true of Ezekiel, one of two Vermont farmers who were chatting together while seated on a bench located on the town commons. Ezekiel was complaining, "That wife of mine is the beatenest woman. Keeps asking for money. She asked me for $10 a month or so ago. Then a couple of weeks later, she asked me for $15. And just today, she wanted $25. "What does she do with the money?" asked the other farmer. "Don't know," countered Ezekiel. "Never give her none." E.M. Forster, in his inspiring Two Cheers for Democracy, has a philosophy directly counter to that of Ezekiel. I quote, "I believe in aristocracy, though if that is the right word, and if a Democrat may use it, Democrat spelt with a little D, not an aristocracy of power based upon rank and influence, but an aristocracy of the sensitive, the considerate, and the plucky. Its members are to be found in all nations and classes, and all through the ages there has been a secret understanding between them when they meet. They resent the true human tradition, the one permanent victory of our queer race over cruelty and chaos. Thousands of them perish in obscurity. A few are great names. They are sensitive for others, as well as for themselves. They are considerate without being fussy. Their pluck is not swankiness, but the power to endure." End of quotation. There are many members of the aristocracy of the considerate. Wealth or lack of wealth has little to do with membership. Sometimes the vicissitudes of life have to strip us of our arrogance or stupidity or selfishness before we're able to choose the real values in living. For instance, the ultimate awakening of Alfred Nobel resulted from the terrifying experience in reading his own obituary. For his invention of dynamite in 1866, he had anticipated its subsequent use as a benefactor of mankind in the construction of roads, dams, building sites. But to his dismay, his invention was perverted through its use in the building of a giant munitions industry. Suddenly and helplessly, for a subsequent 20 years, he stood by while relatives and financiers used his invention in his name to build a monopoly dedicated to the killing of men. In a feeble way, he in those years did try to offset some of the harm by personal efforts in the cultural and humane fields, trying to break down the great barriers that separate men and ideas. But one morning in 1888, he picked up his morning paper to read of his own death. Another man by the same name had actually died. Because of Alfred Nobel's fame, there was literally columns in the newspapers about his supposed death. So the Swiss inveterate industrialist was able to know literally what the world thought of him and the way he had conducted his life. And he saw in these black-edged newspaper columns that the world viewed him as the Dynamite King, a merchant of death. "That is for what I'll be remembered," thought Noble with horror. His recoil from this revolting fact caused Noble to devote his remaining life to helping mankind. And then when he died 8 years after his first obituary, the real obituary detailed something of what an individual could be proud. Most of his vast fortune was and continues to be used to endow the Nobel Prize, which goes periodically to the man who has done the most for the cause of world peace. The more sentient among us will join the aristocracy of the considerate before our obituary is read, for it will be realized that each of us has a responsibility to mitigate the social waste inherent in the average community. Much of the integration, organization, and stability of America comes from the mores and the beliefs of Main Street. Should we not then, as educated citizens, maintain a constant battle to defeat the principle of inertia, which has a parallel in society as well as in physics? Often on my trips to California, I am reminded of a story told me by a San Francisco friend. A Chinese boy, playing on the rooftop of a store in Chinatown, carelessly tossed a rock, and it went through the window of a nearby barber shop. Only a few hours went by before the lad's family had made a visit to the proprietor of the shop, paying him for the damage and sweeping up the broken glass. In the week to come, 50 members of the Chinese Tong, to which the lad's family belonged, had haircuts at the shop whether they needed them or not. The world needs more of this type of integrity. As Confucius put it, and I quote, "When a man understands the nature and use of wisdom, compassion, and courage, he will then understand how to put in order his personal conduct and character. He will understand how to govern nations and empires." There is a definite interrelation between the adult and his self-discipline, his local community duties, and his obligations to the greater community of the world. This is true of people of every country. The strengths and weaknesses we exhibit in our homes, in our blocks, on Main Street, these strengths and weaknesses will eventually become at least drops in the great stream of conscience, in the river of fate, which affects the destiny of the world. New nations, new passions, and new conflicts are erupting all over the map these days. It is a cliche and a platitude to say that man is not ready for the kind of world his machines and weapons have created. But it is true and frightening. Human nature, which refuses to change as rapidly as environment, faces today the dilemma of the ancient dinosaurs. The dinosaurs perished because they couldn't see beyond their local habitat. In closing, may I reiterate, the truly educated man and woman represents our chief basis for optimism concerning the future. Perhaps they will grow in number, and perhaps their wisdom can somehow be communicated to the aggressors of the world. Perhaps vision and action, implemented and coordinated, can rout the fear and lethargy that so strangely walks side by side in our contemporary life. There are no truer words than these. A vision without a task is a dream. A task without vision is a drudgery. But a vision with a task is the hope of the world. Thank you.